Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, December 15th, 2011. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, a very special person, a very special historian, author, poet, Peter Dale Scott, author of his newest book, Deep Politics and the War Machine. And our movie is the wonderful Guerrilla Network news short, Crack the CIA. It was made about the turn of the century, and so it's a little bit dated, but it's a wonderful short, and I think you'll enjoy it. I spoke with Peter earlier this week, and he pointed out that he likes to give long answers, and I love to listen to them. So a heads up that we may go about 15 minutes past the hour this evening. Our theme tonight is the last line from the Ring Around the Rosie nursery rhyme, All Fall Down. As the cash flows recede, you see numerous arrangements fraying, failing, falling, and changing. We saw government alliance changing last week, reverberations all this week about the British pulling out of the changes or not agreeing to the changes in the new Lisbon Treaty with the rest of the Europe. What does that mean? Europe wanted a financial transaction tax, which had been primarily on British financial services. The Brits estimate that as much as 80% of the tax revenues would come from Britain. The Anglo-American Alliance at this point manages about 50% of the financial transactions, so you can imagine what that would mean. But what does that, does the British stay in the EU? Do they leave? It's going to be interesting. But in addition to government alliances falling apart, we're also seeing the relationship between people and governments falling. CBS News reports this week that the recent census data now shows that squeezed by unemployment and rising living costs, a record number of Americans, nearly one out of two, have fallen into poverty or scraping by on earnings that classify them as low income tax. They also reported that most U.S. unemployed are no longer getting unemployment benefits. So as the, again, as the cash flow recedes, you're seeing real tension as the relationship between government and people change. We saw a threat of a shutdown by the U.S. government this week, because of negotiations over extending the payroll tax holiday for 160 million Americans. Finally, government announced, the Congress announced today that they're going to come up with a deal and vote for an agreement tomorrow, and there's zero chance of a shutdown. But it would have been very interesting to see what the Americans people would have done if Congress had delivered a government shutdown as its Christmas present to their constituents. And gold fell from not the annual high, but an interim high as the news grew uglier on MF Global and David Cameron balked at more centralization with the EU. Gold took a swan dive of almost 200 points starting last week, and it's very interesting. On Thursday night, Franklin said, you know, we're at a crossing point. It's either going to go up or down. And talked a lot about the charts, and he said, wait for 2 days of confirmation. And sure enough, on Thursday night, Friday was the first day, Monday was confirmation. Sure enough, it fell out of bed over the weekend. So, but more on that, money and markets. Thank heavens for Christmas and the holidays. I have to tell you, given all the news, if it wasn't for Christmas, it would be a difficult time. I have chestnuts roasting in the oven, and my Tennessee office smells lovely. The decorations are up. And basically, it's time to ignore the news and make merry, as far as I'm concerned. Money and markets. The top story this week was the congressional passage of this year's National Defense Authorization Act. There's one every year, but this year very much debated and discussed on the internet because of provisions for detaining people considered to be suspected terrorists, as well as a variety of other provisions, including those affecting the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. The bill was sent to the White House today. Senate Armed Service Committee Carl Levin said, those who say that we have written into law a new authority to detain American citizens until the end of hostilities are wrong. Neither the Senate bill nor the conference report establishes new authority to detain American citizens or anybody else. However, the bill does create a new codified legal basis for the detention of, quote-unquote, suspected terrorists and their allies. And the final legislation states that nothing in it may be, quote, construed to affect existing law or authorities relating to the detention of United States citizens, lawful resident aliens of the United States, or any other persons who are captured or arrested in the United States, unquote. Now, I'm not sure I agree with Senator Levin on this one. The current so-called law on detention and the definition of what a terrorist is keeps getting, or a suspected terrorist, keeps getting murkier and murkier. This bill underscores why I get so concerned about the possibility of constitutional amendments. I believe that the language affirmatively protecting U.S. citizens, I believe in this law that there was, in the draft, there was language at one point affirmatively protecting U.S. citizens, and it was removed. Change the Constitution, and what that then means is that this bill, therefore, has a much different meaning to U.S. citizens, and that's why I continue to be very concerned about grassroots movements that make the idea of a constitutional amendment or a constitutional convention fashionable, because that's going to give some very dangerous people the power to hijack the process in a way that could lead to tremendous day-to-day violence in a world that most middle-class Americans have never experienced. So it's important to remember that we do not have an economic problem, we've got a political problem, and we need to worry about the law that protects everyone in addition to protecting our assets, because ultimately they're absolutely one and the same. Now, the MF global saga continued, and I've continued to watch it pretty carefully with help from my attorney, because I think the part of the sort of the behavior you're watching in the financial markets is very much connected to what's been happening at MF Global. Last week we saw the former chairman, John Corzine, also former chairman of Goldman Sachs, testify that he knew nothing until late in the game. This week Corzine testified again in the Senate and was followed by the CME, the exchange head, Duffy, who says that that he believes the problem was not an accounting error or mistake, but a violation of rules, which is a nice way of saying an illegal action. There's 1.2 missing from about 5 to 6 billion of customer accounts. Most of that is in U.S. futures accounts, and there's an additional 250 million in the securities and foreign accounts. The trustee has now paid out, has authorized the transfer of about 4.2 billion of customer accounts. That's expected to be about 72% of what should be in their accounts. One of the ways that happened was the CME put up a guarantee of $500 million to protect against any clawbacks that the judges could authorize. So there's a significant amount of money in play. The judge says they will address physical assets, which includes the gold and precious metals payout in January. Part of the reason for the delay is the issues related to paying out pieces of a bar. And that's part of the problem of what you have with an unallocated pool holding. If the firm has a 400-ounce bar and everybody's got 2 ounces, how do you whack up the bar? Corzine testified in the Financial Service Committee today in the Senate. He insisted again that he didn't know of any misuse of government accounts. A lot of questionings about whether or not there were loopholes in the regulations between here and the UK that allowed them to use customer account or customer account funds to support their European bond position, which is a possibility. But there's several issues going on here that make this case very important. One is the fact that the integrity of customer accounts has been broken, and real questions about the loopholes in the regulation and whether or not assets have been used to support several positions in what you've often heard me refer to as collateral fraud. And it reminds me, I said this again last week, but I'll say it again, it reminds me of the Barings case. We talked about the movie about Barings, the failure of the Barings firm in the 90s is one of the let's go to the movies in a Solari report last year, the year before, because it tells the story of a trader who lost a certain amount of money, but once it was clear that the firm went down, what later came out, let's say the trader lost X, what later came out was that the missing money was 10X. And you see real patterns in these kinds of situations when a firm's not going to make it. Suddenly they get stripped bare at the last 2 minutes, or trading losses from other places get moved in. And it's sort of a way of stripping something as it goes down. And it certainly feels and looks so far that something here really stinks more than Corzine making a big bet and losing. So I still continue to see who stole what and where it is. We don't know yet, but I think it's probably related to what's going on in the precious metals market. The housing market, we continue to get lots of reports of softness in the market despite continued low mortgage interest rates. The realtors have now been forced to come out and do their numbers. Turns out their numbers were a little more aggressive than reality in terms of sales and inventories over the last year. It's important to remember in the housing market that markets vary tremendously by place, but I expect this softness to continue for a while. The market can't clear, and that's clearly the result of very official government and banking policies making sure it's so. What's happening is the capital is being preserved for government and corporate debt and basically pulled out of residential housing. And that's not necessarily from a policy standpoint such a bad idea to not, you know, if anything, America has put far too much capital into residential housing as opposed to more productive assets. But at the same time, you know, following a housing bubble as significant as it was, it's a pretty sort of ugly picture. Well, that gets us to the gold price, which I know is on the minds of many of the subscribers this week. We're seeing real tensions in both in the derivative swap market that are spilling over into gold as people need dollars in the derivative market. Needless to say, the dollar skyrocketed this week through, it finally made it through 80, which I've been expecting this year, and it's just hovering a little bit above 80 now. It appears that some of the European banks needed dollars and were selling gold. More importantly, I think what we saw, and this is a guess because we don't have the information to prove it, but I think what we saw was a highly concerted effort to lay in shorts and then bring the price down over the last week and early this week, over last weekend and early this week. And the profits from those trades was enough to engineer filling up and covering some of the shortfall that sort of led to the play. Now, if I had to guess, we're coming into the year-end books being closed out at the end of the fourth quarter. So 12/31 for many financial institutions is the end of the year, and somebody needed to cover a big position before the end of the year. You know, did it come out of MF Global? Did it come out of the European deal? I think all these things are connected, but the picture looks murky. One of my concerns was that some of the shorts were not only in the futures markets, but in the big ETFs. If you haven't read the article that I wrote with Carolyn Betts, the GLD and SLV disclosure in the Precious Metals Puzzle Palace, I've recommended to you. But there is real, in my opinion, lack of integrity in the sort of collateral, in the depository arrangements behind those ETFs. We describe it in detail in the article, and if you look at some of what's going on with MF Global, sure enough, it's the two custodians for the two depositories for the big ETFs, JP Morgan Chase and HBC, are up to their neck in it. And in fact, HBC has brought a lawsuit over a small amount of gold held by a MF Global client who wants to take delivery of their precious metals, and they've basically filed a case to force the trustee to make a decision on this. But I suspect behind that small position, there are lots of other big positions. And needless to say, a lot of people are asking questions about whether or not some of this gold has been used to hypothecate more than once. And it's interesting that the trustee is saying they're not going to turn and deal with the hard assets until after the year-end books close. So it's important to remember that if the people who manage the global financial system are going to continue the slow burn, then they have to really keep a balance between the performance in the gold and silver markets, the commodities market, and the stock, bond, and currency markets. The precious metals markets are tiny. The broader commodities markets are larger, but the stock, bond, and currency markets, so financial paper, is even larger. And, of course, we've seen an explosion of paper over the last several decades. So managing the financial system means that there are points at which you have to bring the sort of the tangible markets and the paper markets back into balance, and that's what we see. We saw almost a 200-point drop, and I would call it a whack. But what it really did was it brought things back in balance, given what's going on in Europe and MF Global, and given that we're coming into the year-end numbers. So what we just saw was a rebalancing between tangibles and paper to defend paper's role, and somebody engineered it in a way I'm sure made him a huge amount of money. We got a question from a reader when you've spoken about the volatility of markets, this is in effect the new normal. It's still very difficult to stomach such extremes within a very short period in precious metals, particularly in gold. To say that it gives one pause is an understatement. Would you agree with the title of this article from Gold Money that, quote, the song remains the same, and with this comment by Frank, can't pronounce his name, Gustra, the bottom line is that the money needed to bail out Europe and to fund American spiral debt and future unfunded obligations is in the tens of trillions. It does not exist. It has to be created by printing money in massive quantities, and despite all the rhetoric you will hear against these policies, in the end, it's the path of least resistance. Printing money is the invisible tax on savings, much easier to initiate than, say, raising taxes or cutting back on services and entitlements. And then another quote from Jim Sinclair's latest article, Fear Not, Gold Bugs, the song remains the same. Yes, I do agree with Turk and Sinclair on this one. I think we're going to see the price stay in the 1550 to 1650 range through the end of the year. And then the question is, how soon can it rise? A lot of that's going to depend on whether the people who whacked it down need it that way for the end of the year. They also need it before they put out their annual reports in March. Nothing's changed, and I think the long-term bull market in precious metals still continues. The key, though, is will the reengineering that we're watching, will the financial coup d'etat proceed with inflation or deflation? And that's why the law and my sort of jumping up and down about don't mess with the Constitution comes up and is so important. It's a lot easier if you are the people governing the financial system to handle things with inflation than a deflation. But if you change the law and really drive a truck through the Constitution, you can manage a deflation because a deflation is going to be a lot less popular for most people. So the politics is really important. But expect this volatility to continue and to get worse. It's all part of sort of the battle that's raging between empire and global factions and the collateral fraud in the financial system. And that's why greater personal and family self-sufficiency and resiliency is such a great investment. The difference between market prices and real values are going to swing widely. There's opportunity in that, but there's also stress. Another question for Ask Krathen before we go to our interview. It looks like Ron Paul's momentum is increasing and he's gaining more traction. What are the real-life possibilities with him in the White House? How does his ethos permeate throughout the entire administration, i.e. cabinet members, heads of executive offices like FDA, Treasury, Defense, Secretary of State? And what are the chances of another Biddle versus Jackson-type battle and the fallout of such for the American economy? I think there's no chance that Ron Paul will win the presidency because the people, there are too many people who have the ability to basically do to Ron Paul what they did to Paul Wellstone or John F. Kennedy. So, you know, in that vein, it's very appropriate that we're talking to Peter Del Scott tonight. But I think the chances of him becoming president are small. I intend to do everything I can to support his candidacy, however, because I think it can have a really positive effect. And, of course, I'm open to miracles if Ron Paul gets in the White House. I want to recommend to you there's a book that people who go to Washington always use. It's called The Prune Book, and it's been turned into a website called Prunes Online. The URL is excellenceintransition.org. Ron Paul's been in Washington for a long, long time now. And the reason that's important is he's got the knowledge and the staff and the networks to pick out very, very good people, not only who are aligned with his philosophy, but have the experience and the knowledge of the machinery to manage those agencies. And so it's extremely important, the quality of people who you put into those positions, no matter how much the machinery and the finances make, you know, really drive policy in a way that the machinery can't control. Very high-quality people can make an enormous difference. So if you're interested in that area, certainly lobbying the candidates to get very good people in there is important, but the Prune Book will really help you understand sort of the nuts and bolts of the different positions. Okay, so that's it for Ask Krathen. Not a lot of questions, but very good ones tonight. Well, not surprisingly, our hero this week is the person we're interviewing. It's Peter Dale Scott, and Peter has an amazing experience in life. He was a Canadian diplomat and became a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, where he now lives, and he became very interested in American history and sort of the news or the deeper story of what was going on, and has been one of the most, I would say, one of the most important historians of sort of our generation, of people who, historians who really wrote the truth, not the official reality, but really dug in deep and started to look at the deeper issues of what was going on. And every time Peter publishes a book, I've read most of his books, I think I've read all of his books, and or most of his history or political writing. And every time Peter comes out with a book, I immediately get it, because it's sort of on people who are really interested in politics and American history. He really is considered a must-read. And Peter recently published his latest book, The American War Machine, Deep Politics, the CIA Global Drug Connection, and the Road to Afghanistan. And to say it's a tour de force is an understatement. It's an absolutely brilliant work because it brings together and integrates so much work that Peter's done and his different books along the way. And it does it, one of the things that makes it so special is it does it to a level of sort of academic standards of excellence, which is very, very difficult to do if you're writing about these topics. It takes incredible discipline, many, many years, and so Peter has accomplished that. And I had the opportunity when I was out in California last year to go have dinner with Peter and his wife in Berkeley, and I have to tell you, it was one of the most fascinating dinners and experiences that I've ever had, because when you talk with Peter, he is such, and you know, I'll let him convey this himself because it always comes through, he's not only a brilliant person and an incredibly accomplished academic, historian, author, he's also just a wonderful human being, and that's why whenever I read Peter's work or I spend time talking to him, I come away with this sense of, you know, the world really can make sense, and we really can, as Foster Gamble would say, thrive, and I just feel so much more coherent. So it's a real pleasure to welcome Peter Dale Scott.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I hope I'm not an anticlimax after that. but I would agree that the last book I wrote, American War Machine, is probably the one which does most to pull together all the different research I've done through the last 40 or 50 years.
Well, you, why don't we start with, it'd be good to just walk through your books and hear you tell the story of how how a professor of English came to write some of the most important definitive history of the American Empire.
Yes, I think it's useful to see how I got drawn into this. When I left the Canadian Foreign Service in 1961 and came to Berkeley, I thought that I was giving up politics. I don't have a PhD in English. I have one actually in political science, but it's on the social and political ideas of T.S. Eliot. So I've always had a double interest in literature, particularly poetry, and in politics. And actually, I published an essay recently online how I say I think the two go together, that my interest in deep politics digs into the unknown in a way that poetry also goes to the back of the mind. I won't try to develop that here, but I began getting interested in politics again because I had been exposed to the problems of Indochina when I was a Foreign Service officer. And as I saw America beginning to edge towards major involvement in Vietnam, in a very small way, I circulated petitions and maybe wrote an article saying that America shouldn't do this for America's sake. And then when Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, my first book was a book called The Politics of Escalation, which was, it was a bit late now to say America shouldn't get involved, but we tried to track, there were three of us co-authors, and we tried to track how America embarked on what I thought was a crazy initiative, just as I believe that, that going into Iraq was a crazy initiative. And in writing about Vietnam, I became convinced that a very major decision had been made the same weekend that the president was shot, in fact, within 48 hours of his being shot. It, not a decision to go to war, but a decision to prepare for war, which had war in the offing. So that's how an interest in foreign policy in Vietnam became an interest in the Kennedy assassination. And that eventually led to my coining this notion of deep politics, that there are events, things going on under the surface that we have to look at. And this, in turn, leads to what I talk about very often nowadays are deep events like the Kennedy assassination, which are portrayed in the media as being accidents or things that come in from irrational outside forces, a lone nut Marine in the case of the Kennedy assassination, but which, in fact, are... flow from forces going on under the surface of American politics, which have, over the last half century particularly, been leading us more and more in the direction of global domination through the use of violence, which I regret and oppose, because I love this country, but I think it has been badly served by these forces which have broken in on the American political process. And that's one of these dark forces, if you want a phrase for it, American War Machine, which is the title of my last book.
Well, you know, let's just spend a little bit of time on the Kennedy assassination, because to me, the Kennedy assassination is such a the fact not just that it happened, but the people who engineered it got away with it, and it was never, transparency was never brought to what happened. Is one of the most important things that ever happened in American history.
I could just, I totally agree. And if I just starting on the most simple and obvious level, good politics are based on trust, bad politics are based on fear. And whatever else you believe about the Kennedy assassination, I think everyone has to agree that it was the beginning of a serious erosion of trust in the American political process. I think personally, you know, because of what I believe, I would say that increase of mistrust was in a sense justified, but it's also very sad because America at its best has flourished when people are willing to trust in the system and the process. And if it's true, as I believe it is, that the assassination was engineered on a high level, I never pretend to know who killed the president, but I get a stronger and stronger picture of people from different departments of the U.S. government, FBI, particularly CIA, but also the military, military reserve, some major private corporations. If it's true that these people did it and got away with it, that does raise real questions about the legitimacy of government. And it also, I think, explains why we've had more deep events that circle back and with some of the same personnel, because they have to go on ensuring that the truth won't come out. It wasn't a one-time job. You publish the Warren Report and then everyone will forget about it. No, there is a small percentage of Americans that continue to be obsessed with the assassination, learn more and more about it. And at higher levels, too, some people have been interested. And we see further events. I believe that Watergate, I have for decades believed that the mysteries of Watergate, another deep event, when I say the mystery, what Nixon did, a lot of it was very well documented, But why people went into the Watergate offices of the DNC in the first place, I think, has not been resolved. But there are more and more books now that suggest that it was something done to damage Nixon, not in service of him. And I believe also that that had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. So I agree with you that the Kennedy assassination was the beginning of a serious deterioration in American politics, both on trust on the most popular level, but also a corruption of institutions at a higher level.
Well, you know, what I found in my work, because I tend to go back and study both the drugs as a cash flow in business, narcotics trafficking, as well as financial fraud. And the two are very, if you come into any county in America, Peter, you'll see that mortgage fraud and narcotics trafficking are tied at the hip because one's laundering the other. And
right.
So
I'm so glad you brought up drugs at this point because I first of all, it gets a bit technical, but there is a drug aspect to the Kennedy assassination. There is certainly a very strong drug aspect to the Cubans who went into the DNC offices in Watergate. The myth of the sovereign state is that it holds a monopoly of power, and the fact anyone who's lives in a depressed neighborhood knows that the power of the state is contested by the powers of gangs and of organized crime, and that the center of that alternative power is the drug trade and the huge profits that are in it, and which incidentally are guaranteed by absurd policies of prohibition that keep prices high. And when I'm talking about depolitics, I've always defined it, well, I'm going to read a little bit from what I say about depolitics in American War Machine, but I've recycled this through my last, I actually have a book with the in which Deep Politics is the title, Deep Politics and the Death.
I have to say this, it's a wonderful book.
Well, I think what's good about it is that I was not trying to tell people who did it. I was trying to tell people what we learned about American society by the phenomenon and the cover-up which followed. What I say here, an American War Machine, is it's the constant everyday interaction between the constitutionally elected government and subterranean forces of violence, forces of crime, that appeared to be the enemies of that government. And then I give the example that the CIA, for most of its existence, operated under a secret exemption from legal review of its actions. I wonder if your listeners knew that. The Attorney Generals of the United States didn't know it was such a secret arrangement. It was done back in 1952 that Robert Kennedy only learned about it when he wanted to go after the CIA's using mafia figures to assassinate Castro, and found that the CIA was immune from any kind of prosecution on that. So, and yes, the reality of life in a drug neighborhood is that if people have to choose between offending government or offending the local enforcers of crime, tend to be more frightened of the enforcers of crime than of the government, and that is a reality that we live in. It's a reality that it goes up and down in American history. It's not new. But one of the reasons it's up recently is because of, if I could say one single reason for it, is the criminalization of the use and sale of marijuana. Maybe there are some arguments why marijuana should not be used. I haven't used it myself for 40 years because the illegal sources now are so strong, I don't want to go near it. But it explains so much. I mean, most of the revenues for the drug mafias, the cartels, as we call them in Mexico, is from marijuana. They're also making money from cocaine, but they don't grow it. They do grow marijuana by the tens of hectares, and it's huge. And it's huge in California. It's probably the number one crop in California, and California isn't taxing it. Whereas if everybody grew their own, they would be smoking a milder and safer form of marijuana, and you would take the heart out of the business, the dollars in the drug trade, which are dangerous for society because, among other things, they buy influence with politicians and help corrupt our government.
Well, Peter, for many years, when I first started to study the drug trade, and I followed sort of who was doing narcotics trafficking or coordinating through the intelligence agencies and who was doing financial fraud, and I saw the linkages, and I just tried to understand the history of narcotics trafficking and financial fraud, say, from the creation of the Federal Reserve on. It was amazing because for the first time I felt like I understood the history of America. In other words, all these different disjointed events that didn't seem to make sense suddenly all came, you know, into an integrated whole because you could see. One of the things I found that I think I wanted to mention was the people who appeared to be part of whether it was the assassination or the cover-up were really empowered by the fact that they got away with it. And that leads us right into Iran-Contra. And then they were, as a financial matter, they were empowered that they got away with that. And then if you look at the fraud that occurred in the housing bubble or in the pump and dumps in the stock market in the 90s, it really, you know, it was the same sort of players. And they, you know, from the Kennedy assassination all the way through the latest housing bubble, it's like one flow, except they just keep getting more and more emboldened to be more, you know, to take more and more and more. And behind all of it is this violence that we all pretend isn't really happening, but it is.
You know, you said so much there, I'm not quite sure where I should come in. Let's go back to the creation of the Federal Reserve, which was within 7 years of the international convention which first outlawed the trafficking in narcotics. I think the original intentions of America in this were benign. That's to say, the most of the fuss about the drug traffic had to do with China and the narcotization of China. And the British Empire funded itself by the sale of opium from India to China. Missionaries were reporting back to both England and America. The civil servants kept saying how benign the drug trade was, and the missionaries who saw the social consequences kept saying how terrible it was. Of course, the prohibition of drugs in America got tied in with initially the prohibition of alcohol. And the absurdity of the alcohol thing was a much larger phenomenon, and its absurdity led to the repeal of prohibition with respect to alcohol. It would have been good for the world, I think, if the repeal of prohibition on narcotics had gone the same way. But what happened was the opposite. There were numbers and numbers of prohibition agents who now didn't have a job. And Anslinger, who headed the Federal Bureau of Narcotics at that time, solved the problem by discovering the horrors of what he called reefer madness, the dangers of marijuana. It's really amazing to go back and read the literature that the...
Oh, I've read it. It's amazing.
You know,
year after year, they're telling
stories about... It's usually very racist. It's usually about a young Mexican who smoked one marijuana joint and then killed his mother. And this stuff was being put out emphatically over the years by Anslinger. And he was the source of other lies, too, which are more pertinent, really, to what we're talking about. One was that he, the head of the FBM, essentially protected the reappearance of a global drug traffic after World War II, because particularly in opium, most of America's opium was coming from Southeast Asia. Al McCoy wrote a book about this and the politics of heroin. The facts are very clear that the drug traffic, which was beaten back to almost nothing during the war because civilian shipping came to a standstill, particularly across the Pacific. But after the war, the opium production for the American market shot upwards, and it was being done under the auspices of private armies that were being used, and more than used, but assisted very seriously, assisted by the CIA. Now, Al McCoy's understanding of this is that the CIA did this, turning a blind eye to the drug trade. But no, I think that the CIA wanted a flourishing drug trade in Southeast Asia because they were very worried about the loyalties of the Chinese populations in the cities there. There were Chinese in Saigon, in Jakarta, in Singapore, in Kuala Lumpur, everywhere. And in the normal course of things, when they always sent remittances back to the mother country, and if there hadn't been a serious intervention, those remittances and those populations would probably have turned their eyes to the new Chinese People's Republic in mainland China. But that was stopped, and one of the main reasons for stopping it was that the Kuomintang, which was the political organization of Chiang Kai-shek, had very strong roots in all those cities. It had always funded itself by drugs, including in America. The various tongs of Chinatown were passionately anti-communist and deeply involved with organized crime and the drug traffic. And this was true also in Southeast Asia. And the CIA liked this and helped it. And I think the proof, if there's any single thing that proves not only that this, because it's known that the army, the KMT army in Burma, was working full time on collecting drugs, opium, and shipping it down to Bangkok, from which it went to Hong Kong and eventually America. And so they're turning up in the streets of New York, Boston, San Francisco. The CIA knew it, and I think we can show that they wanted it, because if they didn't want it, it would have been very important to control closely the airplanes that were flying arms into these KMT bases in Burma. But the CIA did exactly the opposite. They wanted an operation that was plausibly denial. So they set up the firm we now know as Air America, was called CAT back in the 50s, and the CIA controlled the workshops in Taiwan where the planes were fixed. The CIA controlled the pilots, but the planes themselves were 60% owned by KMT bankers in Taiwan. So that allowed the CIA to use the planes to fly arms into these bases, and then they'd say, "Oh well, when the planes fly back, that's not our plane. It's the it was being used
by the Taiwanese
to bring the drugs out." And this went on in a huge way. I mean, the Southeast Asia went from something like 80 tons of opium a year being grown at the end of the war to, at the peak of the Vietnam War, it was something like 1,200 tons. So
it's huge.
Small. And that was the center of the opium trade in the world then. And then, of course, when the Americans began to pull out of Indochina in the 1970s, and particularly out of Laos, where a lot of the drugs came from, the 70s is the decade when we begin to get drugs, opium, for the first time from the Golden Crescent, which is to say the Pakistan-Afghan border. And now It's minor in Southeast Asia. America's gone. And it's absolutely huge in Afghanistan, which is, even though it's come back a bit recently, it's still in the order of 90, 92, 93% of the global production of opium. So
before we get to Afghanistan, can we touch on what happened in Mena, Arkansas, and the crack cocaine explosion that occurred with Iran-Contra?
Yes, there was certainly, you're absolutely right. There was a crack epidemic that, if you read any history of cocaine, that some of them started in the 60s, some of them started with Nixon's declaration of a war on drugs, but everybody agrees that it suddenly went viral in the 1980s and became huge. And this was at a time, of course, when we were sponsoring, the CIA, were, have to be careful here, Americans, because
right.
The CIA didn't, initially it was the CIA, and later it was Oliver North and his enterprise, but they were sponsoring Contras in Central America. I think this is in the popular, most Americans know that there were allegations of that this support of the Contras was related to the drug increase of cocaine in America. It wasn't primarily the Contras themselves, although some of them were involved, but it was very much the infrastructure that was set up to fly arms into from America down to Central America and give arms to those people. Most of these planes were being flown by Americans, not by Central people from Central America. And
right.
It was a matter of fact, as came out in hearings, that these planes would fly into particularly Fort Lauderdale and they were not looked at because they were part of this covert operation. And there are certainly documented cases when drugs were seized on these planes. One of these planes was owned by a major trafficker in Honduras called Mata Ballesteros. And he bought himself a CIA immunity by lending planes to the Contra supply effort. American AP, Associated Press, in the mid-80s, wrote a story which never made it into American papers, but it was by a very good journalist. I think he had won maybe even a Pulitzer Prize or something. And in that story, he estimated that Honduras was supplying, as of course a way station, the cocaine was coming from Peru and from Colombia, increasingly from Colombia. But Honduras was handling something like a third of it, and I believe he said that most of that was being handled by this single man, Mata Ballesteros. And the fact that he was an important drug trafficker was illustrated by the fact that within days of Congress finally in 1988 terminating any kind of assistance to the Contras, that was the end of the game, and then they moved in and they didn't extradite him from Honduras. They kidnapped him in Honduras and flew him to the United States. That's how keen they were to get him. But for years, he had operated under this CIA immunity because his planes were, and I believe his cash, too, were supporting the Contras. So there's a definite connection between drugs and covert operations in the 1980s. People are most aware of Contragate down in Nicaragua. But from the very beginning in Afghanistan, the American equipment, arms, etc., all kinds of aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan was being handled by planes and ships that were connected with BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was a serious drug bank with its own enforcer squads, contributed to the corruption of people all over the world, including the United States. That's another aspect of it, that drug money being so huge that one of the spinoffs is that a lot of that money is going to be used to supply what the Russians call a roof for the trade, protection in high places of government. The old FDM became so corrupted they had to close it down, and very quickly they had to close down its replacement, and now we have DEA, but DEA is also being corrupted. Customs is being corrupted. For years, Hoover wouldn't touch drug enforcement because he was certain it would corrupt the FBI. But now the FBI's in, and there have been examples. I think the FBI comes out better than some other agencies, but yes, corruption there too. So if we want to end all this corruption, as I say, one of the first things we could do is begin at least selectively by decriminalizing one drug, which would be marijuana.
Marijuana. Well, the number of arrests every year for marijuana are just astonishing.
And our jails are overflowing. We have, you know, we in China lead the world in the number of people, the percentage of our population we put in behind bars. It's over 2 million now, I think. And a lot of these people are not guilty of any crime of except a crime that is being artificially defined as one by the anti-marijuana laws.
Peter, the when I went back to try and understand how things had sort of gotten so bad, what I saw was that when we passed the CIA Act National Security Act, I guess, in 47, and then the CIA Act in 49, we created a mechanism for government debt and borrowing to be used to finance black projects on a non-accountable basis. And that money was being pooled along with the drug money. The two were connected. And then in 1980, we created an executive order that said that money that private corporations could be paid to do secret and classified functions with this money. And what that did in combination was it created a near infinite amount of money for private corporations to own and control the most powerful technology on the planet, including weaponry. And
more about this than me, but there is something else that happened at the same time. And when Reagan was elected in 1980, was in the middle of a major oil crisis, and the price of oil, it doesn't seem so big now, but it seemed huge back then. And this destabilized the American currency. Interest rates were sky high. And in various ways, the Reagan administration courted drug money. They issued bearer bonds for treasury bonds, for example. The FBI warned not to do it because they said it would be an invitation for organized crime to buy them. But I think Reagan's treasury secretary, that's exactly what he wanted. And then there was what was a fairly major crisis that Mexico was going to declare bankruptcy and stop paying interest to the American banks. And this would have meant they were so overexposed on loans to Mexico and Brazil that if Mexico had defaulted, I've read that if the American banks had then written off those loans, they themselves would have been technically bankrupt because they wouldn't have had the reserves that they were required by law to have. So what Reagan did, the administration did, was bail out Mexico. But it's very interesting, they didn't bail out Mexico until they had the CIA analyze where Mexican foreign reserves were coming from. And you can actually see the document. It was reprinted in a book called The Underground Empire. The CIA came back with an estimate that 75% of the currency earnings of two countries, Colombia and Mexico, derived from the drug traffic. So what that meant was that drug money was able to pay back Mexico's loan that was advanced by Reagan, so that they were counting on drugs. And Colombia consistently has been the one country that has had no problem making its debt payments to the United States. So you can imagine what the private investors in Colombia feel about the drug trade. They can't be really very opposed to it. The same thing happened in a far bigger way with Clinton, by the way. Was it 1994, 1995, when he just overnight advanced, what was that, $40 or $50 billion that he gave to Mexico?
Yeah, it was very, it was not, I think it was 95. It was very significant.
And they were counting on drugs to balance the books eventually, which they did. I have a story in American War Machine about the big sting that was organized by DEA, where they created a casino outside of Las Vegas and had all these Mexican bankers come and discuss money laundering. And they wanted to move in and arrest all these people, but it was too big. They couldn't do it. And finally, there's it's not in my book, but the case of Wachovia Bank, where they admitted to not. This became prominent because a plane was caught with what was $100 million of cocaine on it, and the plane had been financed by two accounts in Wachovia and the Bank of America. And this led to prosecution of the Wachovia Bank, which conveniently went bankrupt and was assumed by Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo later admitted, if you read the AP story, or no, sorry, the Bloomberg version of the story, they admitted that they had failed to exert what the legal oversight over $380 billion worth of financial transactions. The Agence France-Presse account of the DEA press conference says it was $420 billion. That's one bank. So you can see how huge this has been. And then, of course, finally, Costa, the UNODC representative who monitors the drug trade and crime, drug crime for the UN, said that in the latest, the 98 turndown, that there were banks that only survived by their laundering drug money. He didn't name them, but I'm sure it's true. There was a congressional committee which assumed that it was between $500 billion and $1 trillion worth of hot money a year. The biggest share of that by far would be drug money.
I finally sat down with in one county with a guy who used to deal drugs, and it was a county I know, and went through with him in detail, you know, how much volume there was in all the different categories, and, you know, and I tallied up how much money was coming out of the county just from drugs, and it just astonished me. You know, and if I hadn't just sit down and penciled it out myself on the ground, I would, you know, and of course, when you launder that money in ways that leverage it through the financial market, it turns into a dollar of drug revenues on the ground can be levered into $10, $20, $30 in the capital markets, and there is, so there continues to be that connection between drugs and the financial fraud, and the money gets very, very big pretty quickly. Well, let's go. I wanted you to kind of go through your new book, Peter, and describe sort of why you wrote it and what it says.
Well, I wrote it because I really I had hoped in my previous book, The Road to 9/11, I had wanted to start with the. You talked yourself a few minutes ago about the creation of the CIA in 1947. What really counted back then was the creation, not by statute, but by an executive order, of what was called the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, in 1948. The CIA really was originally conceived of as an intelligence agency to gather information and to circulate it in the government. We now know that it has a covert operations side, but that began outside the CIA as OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination. They are the people who built up the drug trade in Southeast Asia and did a number of other things. They conducted a secret war in the Ukraine that most Americans never knew about and never has been properly described. In fact, and then eventually OPC became such a problem that they felt that it had to be brought under better control. So they put it inside the CIA, but the effect was the opposite. It wasn't that the CIA then controlled OPC. It's really that OPC, ever since the covert operations, have defined the style and the ethos of the agency. And if there's any one individual responsible for that, it's the man they put in charge of watching OPC become the Department of Plans in the CIA. That man was Alan Dulles, and who very soon became the director of the CIA, and of course embarked the CIA on a number of things. People talk about the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs, but Dulles boasted about having overthrown Mossadegh in Iran and having overthrown Arbenz in Guatemala. And both those operations were far bigger fiascos, if you think about them in the long run, because they are the source of the torment in Iran to this day. Now, Iran is a government of mullahs, and the mullahs were the allies of the CIA in Iraq, and Guatemala has been seen really what you could almost call genocide of the native populations for 40, 50, 60 years by the army that was the ally of the CIA in Guatemala. So this was a bad turn of events, and what happened in those states recreated itself. You can trace directly to the bigger disasters in Laos and what is essentially a rerun of Laos today in Afghanistan, which has become a completely corrupt country for the same reason that Laos became a completely corrupt country, because we keep pouring all these billions of dollars into it. And what do you expect but corruption?
Right.
So I may have lost your question there, Catherine.
Finish what the War Machine is such an extraordinary book, in that you tie these different threads into the effort now to build a global empire and why we went into Afghanistan.
Right. Well, I offer the argument, which only occurred to me as I was finishing the book, that the official American policy after the war, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union was and China, was containment. The Republicans ran in 1952 on a program of rollback, that they didn't just want to live with the Russians and the Chinese. They wanted to, there was a huge debate in Congress in those days, who lost China, as if it was ours to lose. And they wanted to get China back. And I realized that the drug trade was important, not just for winning the hearts and minds of the Chinese in Southeast Asia, but also to be a kind of case study and rollback. And that's why we put so much money. We built a private army in Thailand, Paru. Most people have never heard of it. The guy who ran it, and it's quite a decent guy, actually, but in an oral history, he admits that they financed their operations by drugs. And then they went into Laos. Why did America go into Laos? What kind of danger did Laos, country 8 million people, present to America? I thought, well, there were still a number of people who wanted to get China back and who were allied with their hearts were with the KMT in Taiwan. And I think that they hoped, and I'm sure actually some of them hoped, that China would respond to our making war, because this was a war that America unilaterally started in Laos in 1959 and brought in Air America there. And I think that they hoped that China would respond by fighting. China was very circumspect, built up its own army, but was very cautious with respect to what happened in Indochina. But this encouraged, it gave people the idea that rollback was working. It gave America the courage to, there had been a whole war in Indochina with the French that ended in 1956 with the Geneva Accords. That's where I come in, because I had to follow the enforcement of the Geneva Accords, because I was stationed in Poland, and Poland and Canada were on the Control Commission. And America said that they were not going to sign the Geneva Accords, and they said that they weren't going to overtly offend them, but they covertly tried to make them not work, and that, I think, is the true source of the Vietnam War. In other words, it was the true source of what I call the conversion of the Department of Defense into a Department of Offense, until right. By the Reagan years, it was actual doctrine. You had people saying that the Army isn't just there to defend the continental United States. It's to maintain a global order throughout the world, so that this was mostly on a covert level under Reagan, but we were involved in all kinds of places, Angola, Mozambique, that we would not have, and by the way, the Russians were too. I'm not trying to say this was, when I say it was unilateral, the real test case is Afghanistan, because the covert operations began the moment that we had Nixon and Kissinger had made contact with Beijing. Beijing encouraged America to go into Afghanistan, and Brzezinski boasted, really, that he drew the Russians into Afghanistan, gave them, in Brzezinski's words, gave them their Vietnam, which it was for a horrible decade for the Russians in the 80s. Now it's our Vietnam, still a legacy of the intervening there. I guess come back to what the book is saying, that with the aid of the drug trade, in the first four or five chapters are mostly about the buildup of drugs. I take a case history of Mexico and how we became completely involved with the security agency there, the DFS, which became, partly because of us, more and more corrupted by the... They were corrupted by the drug trade from the very beginning, but became more corrupted in the end, which doesn't speak very well for America, which has had a bigger presence in Mexico for a longer time than in any other country. Just seeing how this use of drugs as an asset in covert operations leads to a bigger and bigger offensive capability, until now it's the doctrine of the U.S. Armed forces that they should be able to control any incident anywhere in the world, which is a very large, I would say, really insane conception of what American power can and should be used for. In a sense, the storyline of the book is building up from the drug trade in Burma, and then Thailand, and then Laos, and then Vietnam, and then Afghanistan, up to the war machine that we have trying to dominate the world.
Right, and it makes a lot of things that look kooky today, when you understand this history, they make much more sense. And I think one of my favorite parts of the book, Peter, is towards the end, where you talk about our complicity as a people. Because if you look at the implementation of all of this, you know, it requires, to a certain extent, it requires most of us. most of us, one way or another, get involved in the war machine because it's such a big part of the economy. And we've done a marvelous job of pretending this isn't really going on, you know, and
yes,
that
well,
we're...
I'm ambivalent. Yeah. I really love this country. I'm here by choice. I'm a green card alien. I have not chosen to swear allegiance to the government. Neither would I swear to allegiance to overthrowing it, but I love the people, but I like any people anywhere. I think that the difference between Canada and America is, because Canada is a much smaller country, we have a much stronger sense in Canada that we can do something to affect our government. The sheer size of America as with over 300 million people, which is 10 times the size of Canada, intimidates the ordinary American from thinking that he's responsible. And meanwhile, because of the illegality, the press have been co-opted. The press, what are called the sort of responsible press or the mainstream press, they get their stories from the CIA, so we never get an honest accounting of what the CIA is. And even when they do stories criticizing the CIA, as they do from time to time, they're going to pull their punches when it comes to the drug traffic. This is particularly true with a New York Times reporter on the CIA called Tim Weiner. And he wrote a book, Legacy of Ashes, which is a fairly severe critique of the CIA, but virtually silent when it comes to the question of the CIA and the drug trade. This is
I found both in the press and in government, people were afraid because there's, you know, as you just, and you do a great job of this in the book, describing the sort of covert violence that runs throughout the system. And I think there is a lot more violence, and this is a very violent machinery that if you don't stay within, you know, your prescribed lines, it can be very dangerous. So
yes, well, we've had, of course, as you alluded earlier in the program, a number of people. Kennedy is not the only unsolved assassination. We have his brother, we have Martin Luther King, famous ones, but in the private sphere too, this has gone on. The people who've looked closely at the death of Walter Reuther, I mean, officially that was just a plane accident, like Paul Wellstone. He had been receiving death threats for some time before. Yes, violence is a way of life in America. America is such an enormous experiment in organizing society differently that it has given a great deal of freedom to individuals. It's given a great deal of freedom to corporations. That's become coded in law, and I rather like the Bernie Sanders proposed constitutional amendment, which would say that corporations should not be given the rights given to persons. And it's given a lot of freedom to organize crime, so that there's a lot of violence going on. Actually, my book begins with a little anecdote about Al McCoy, the great expert on heroin, and myself going down to interview somebody from Special Forces who had said in a meeting where I had been present that he had seen opium loaded on an Air America plane. And I phoned him from my house and said, "Will you talk to us?" And he said, "Yes." And we arrive the next morning, and he won't talk to us, and he points to his MG. He's really not talking. He points to the MG he owns, and there's a hole in the steel door a foot wide, and he said that was done by an implosive device. It must have been the people from my own unit. So, yes, he was frightened, and he was frightened
right.
because of something that happened in a phone call between me and him. So that leaves me wondering who is behind all this. And at first I thought it was the CIA, and now, quite for reasons we don't have time in this show, I think it's maybe a force higher than the CIA.
There are these
dark forces, and they're tied up with economics, they're tied up with politics, and ultimately, it's violence, and it's violence that sears an open society based on forces of persuasion. That's the ultimate choice of forms of power, hard power, soft power. America has plenty of both. America could be a great influence in the world if it would resolve to deal with the rest of the world through its soft power, which is not minimal by any means. But anyway, you can't get my book down into a 1 hour or half hour.
I know. It's fabulous. And for people who are looking for a great book.
And I say one more thing that I get into at the end is the privatization of enforcement. I have a whole chapter about private agencies, and there's been about serious erosions of liberty, particularly since 1980, which was a real turning point.
I
have been used to having my phone tapped and things like that. I never particularly worried when it was the CIA and the FBI because I was not ashamed of what I was doing, and I didn't mind if they knew. But I'm more worried now when it's private agencies who are in the business of surveillance of Americans for profit. A profit motive is a bad motive because they have a stake, actually, in disorder and mistrust and fear. I take one corporation alone, SAIC, but there are a great many of them. And at the same time, now America has become, as we've been reading in the papers recently, we have militarized the surveillance of America. We used to have the Posse Comitatus Act, which forbade a regular use of the army for these purposes. That's been overridden now since 9/11. Well, we haven't said very much about 9/11, but the changes in our constitutional situation that happened after 9/11, with the proclamation of an emergency still in force, and rules of continuity of government, which have been expanded since 9/11, mean that we now have America is now a military district, NORTHCOM, which is overseen and surveilled by a military command, the way that Latin America. And we have SOUTHCOM in Latin America, CENTCOM in for Central Asia. This is a very un-American turn of affairs, and what I'm calling
for.
Yeah,
we've become a global district in the empire, and they're trying to get us on the same legal model as all the other districts.
Right. The thinking and the planning and the operations at the top of government are so remote now from. And so unresponsive to the concerns of people, it's not surprising. It's really, I would have said, predictable that you would get movements like the Tea Parties on the right and now the Occupy movement that are going to try and do something about this. They are, both of them, I would say, are far more American than the kind of thinking that's going on in the highest places of government right now.
Peter, I know we're over time, but we have one question about privatization, but you just answered it. I had a great question about privatization. But we have another that I'd love to just get a quick answer from you before we go. Would you say that, this is from a subscriber, would you say that Fidel's longevity has something to do with the CIA drug-related connections dating from the end of the 40s? In fact, the U.S. voted in favor of Cuba Castro being admitted to the Security Council of the UN just 6 months after he liquidated Ochoa for drug trafficking. Fidel as the CIA's most protected agent?
Well, my answer to that would be a little bit different, but along the same lines. I think that if you have a dictator, it's very useful for him to have the CIA opposing him because then he can appeal to he may be unpopular, but the idea that America is going to run that country is even more unpopular. So I think that the fact that back about 20 years ago, the longest living politically surviving dictators in the world were Castro in Cuba, Kim Il-sung in North Korea, and Tito in Yugoslavia. What did these people, three people, have in common? All three cases, less so with Tito, but in all three cases, the U.S. government had committed forces to trying to overthrow them. And that was that meant that they could then appeal to the loyalty of their people, and despite the bad things that all of them did. And I think we're going to, I think that the same thing is true of Iran now. The way things are, we can expect that the Iranians, they have this terrible choice between a government of mullahs, which is very oppressive in many ways, and efforts by the CIA to overthrow it, which for the average Iranian will be even more unpopular, I think. So that's my answer, which is a bit different.
Well, Peter, our time is up, so I want to thank you tremendously for your books, for coming on the Celeria Report, for all you do. And I just want to say to everybody, if you need a great book as a present for Christmas, Peter's latest and all of Peter's books make great Christmas presents for somebody who really wants to explore the truth of American history. So with that in mind, Peter, if you could just say one more word about how we can follow you and stay in touch and keep up to date on your work.
I have a website. It's very simple, Peter, www.peterdalescott, one word, .net, not .com, but .net. And also I have a Facebook page. I'm very clumsy with Facebook, but I try to put a few things up there from time to time. And
of course, we can get all your books on Amazon and the usual suspects.
Yes, and there's a politics page on my website which links to a great many YouTube interviews, videos, audios, and articles that I publish regularly, some of which will be part of my next book. So you can
read. Peter, I'm going to be in California in February, and I very much
I don't want to close. Yeah, Catherine, I'm sorry. I wanted to say, you know, I've listened for the first time to the Solari Report. I found it fascinating. So I look forward to following you and what you're doing.
You now have a complimentary subscription, I hope.
It fits very well with what I'm doing. I mean, you and I from different starting points are poking at the same unresolved mystery at the heart of America.
Oh, I know. So I'm coming in February, and we're going to continue this dialogue.
Absolutely.
Unraveling and bringing transparency to everything.
Okay, thank you very much.
Peter, have a wonderful, wonderful holiday, and best to your wife.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for going with us, but I really wanted to take the full hour with Peter. Quick, one other question for Ask Catherine. Excellent question from a subscriber. Franklin's bias was for gold to go up last week. He was not undecided. Why say otherwise? It's easy to be wrong reading technical stuff. I agree. Absolutely, Franklin's bias was for an up. It's true he was not undecided, but he was very clear, make sure you take 2 days for confirmation. And I obeyed him on that, and I'm glad I did. So I apologize deeply. I didn't mean to indicate otherwise. And I also agree it's very easy to be wrong reading technical stuff, but I do think it's very much worth doing. Anyway, that's it for this evening, and I want to wish you, this is our last Celeria Report of 2011. I want to wish you the happiest of holidays. This is a very special time of year for me. December 24th is my birthday. I always seem to find to have fun celebrating it. I'm going to be over with Franklin and Susan Sanders at Christ Our Hope Church. It's the church they built in Mid-Tennessee, and I'm a member. We have evening services on my birthday on the 24th, and then Sunday services on Christmas Day, celebrating the birth of Christ, a very special event for all of us. We will be giving thanks for many things, including all of you. I want to thank you for your interest, your questions, your great feedback, and all you do in the world. You are a very special group of people, and you're very special to me and the Celeria team. We've had a great year together, and I look forward to 2012. It's the year we've all been waiting for. January 5th, we're going to start off with a year-end wrap-up. We'll look at 2011 and what I think the issues are that need to be addressed and thought about for 2012. If there's anything you want me to touch on, please just post at the blog or send an email, and I will make sure to include that in my consideration of issues for the year. And wrap up January 12th, Precious Metals Market Report. January 19th, great interview with Lynn McTaggart from Europe. She's the author of The Field and the Bond, and we'll follow up on the conversation we began with William Tiller about intention. So until we meet again in 2012, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you definitely need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.